I hope that that's recording. It looks like it's recording on my end, Courtney. So you should be all set. Do you want me to kick off or would you like to kick off, Courtney?
You can kick off.
Okay, well, good more good. Is it morning or afternoon there?
Morning still.
Good morning, everyone. Really good to be with you. It's the second time today I get to say good morning. Yeah, awesome. Really excited to be with you today to talk about CSBG organizational standards and specifically category 8 of the CSBG organizational standards. So just want to say hello. I'm Mary Beth Schnaber-Remrev. I am the Director of Organizational Capacity Building with the National Community Action Partnership. We're really honored and pleased that we were invited by the Office of Community Services to come provide this important training to you. I am an org standards geek. I actually like to talk about the org standards, so I will do my best to contain my geekdom as we go through today's session, but I don't want you to contain yours. So if you have questions, if you have thoughts, this is just going to be a lot more fun if we talk throughout it and if there's participation and all that good stuff. So all doors are valid here. If you would prefer to talk in chat or come off mute, I really welcome any and all of that. So before we go too far, I do want to take a moment to ground us in the promise of community action. The promise reads that community action changes people's lives, embodies the
Embodies
spirit of
the
hope,
hope
improves
of
communities
communities
and
and
makes
makes
America
America
a better place to live. We care about the entire community and we are dedicated to helping people help themselves and each other. I love that you all recited it along with me. That was awesome. I love it when that happens. So, it might feel counterintuitive, but the org standards are an important part of us being able to fulfill this promise because, really, for us to be able to do this, we have to have strong internal organizational systems so that we can deliver on the mission and the promise. And so, org standards might feel like the furthest thing from the standards, but they are really not. So here's just a quick rundown of what I plan to do today, to spend some time talking a little bit high level about the org standards and kind of how to approach them more broadly. And then we're going to dive deep into category 8 during our time together today. So this is the first interactive part, friends. I would love for you to shout it out or put it in the chat. What do you think of when you hear the term organizational standards? What comes to mind for you? Can just be a word, a feeling, policy. Okay. Yeah, there's lots of policies that are required, but it is also kind of a policy that you have to comply with the org standards, right? Compliance. Yeah. All agencies are meant to comply with the org standards. That is a requirement. Best practices. Yeah. So, a number of the org standards are based in kind of legal requirements or other requirements that we have, but also there are a number of them that are really grounded in this is just a best practice that nonprofit entities do. So that's right. Standard operational procedures, SOP. Yeah, awesome. You all are fired up. I love it. So you all are exactly on point about what the org standards are all about. I want to take a moment and just bring you back to, our national theory of change, which really describes what community action seeks to accomplish and how we go about doing that. And across the top of the theory of change, you see we have three big national goals. All community action agencies, in one way or another, work towards one of these three goals or more than one of these three goals. We deploy a number of services and strategies, a lot of times at the same time, blended and braided in a way to help people and communities achieve those big goals. We have some core principles that guide the work that we do. And it is all based on this incredible foundation of a strong community action network coast to coast that includes community action agencies like all of you, your state associations, your state offices, and federal partners who are all supported by the CSBG funding. And you might be going, Mary Beth, you forgot about this performance management block, but I promise I did not. One of the other things that I think is really critical in community action is this idea of performance management, that we care deeply about both the difference that we make, that we have robust results, and we track those things via the national performance indicators that we put into our CSBG annual report. That's how we kind of tell the impact of our work. But in addition to that, we don't only care about those results. We also care that in achieving those results, that we are efficient and effective. And that's where this idea of CSBG organizational standards really comes in, that we want to make sure that all levels of our network are accountable and perform at the highest level possible. And you see, we have org standards in there, along with state and federal accountability measures, and our ROMA system, our results-oriented management and accountability system, which helps us to ensure that we are operating at our best level possible. So let me tell you a little bit about the CSBG organizational standards. They were designed by the network for the network to ensure that all community action agencies, if you're going to put community action agency in your name, you have the needed capacity to fulfill our really critical role and promise to the community. The org standards were developed after years of back and forth input between the local community action network, state associations, state offices, and the Federal Office of OCS. It was a really collaborative and exhaustive effort for any of us who are around then will tell you. As I mentioned earlier, the CSBG organizational standards themselves reflect a number of practices or requirements that are tied to a number of things. Some of the CSBG organizational standards are tied directly to the CSBG Act itself. Sometimes they're tied to OMB, or the Office of Management and Budget guidance, or rules or regulations that you have to follow when you take federal funding. There might be ties to some federal laws and regulation, but then there's a number of them that are also tied to just good management practice, and also importantly, the values of community action and those core principles I just talked about a minute ago. The CSBG org standards were implemented in federal fiscal year 2016. So I just want to note for you that the CSBG Act itself was last reauthorized in 1998. So if you go hunting for where does it say I have to do the CSBG organizational standards, you're actually not going to find it in the current CSBG Act because they came after the CSBG Act was last authorized. That doesn't mean you're not required to do them. I'm sorry. They were actually established in CSBG Information Memoranda 138. And you can check out that information memoranda that comes out from the Office of Community Services, our federal funder. And then they established that all states have to implement the org standards and monitor the org standards for all of their entities on an annual basis. So Courtney is not being mean when she says, I have to assess your compliance with the org standards, because she's really required to as a condition of receiving the CSBG funding from the federal office. So the org standards are divided into three thematic groups, and there are nine total categories. So you can see we have this kind of section on maximum feasible participation. A lot of the standards here tie either to the CSBG Act, but more so the community action principles and values. We have vision and direction. This tends to tie more so to kind of best in class practices for nonprofit organizations and kind of good leadership, good management. And then we have the operations and accountability section. And these categories tend to be a little more rules, law kind of based, if you will. That's just kind of a high overview. So I just started to say this, but I want to make sure I put the point on it. So CSBG, the Community Services Block Grant, is in fact what's called a block grant, which means that the federal office provides general guidance when it distributes funding to the state, but then they leave it up to the states to administer the program, and they leave it up to the state to put in their own rules and regulations for the funding, is what I'm trying to say, excuse me. So sometimes there's going to be times that you're going, well, what do the feds say about this thing in CSBG? And the feds are going to tell you, it's not up to us. We defer that authority to the state. And the org standards, there is a lot of that. The feds don't come out and monitor your org standards compliance. It's really up to the state to do that level of monitoring. Here's the other thing that's really important to note about the org standards then. The implementation guidance and assessment of the org standards are going to differ state to state because of the nature of CSBG. So if you're talking to your friends in other states about, hey, how do you meet the standard? Just know that you, how they do it might be different than how Hawaii approaches it. There's a lot of consistency across the country, but there's also a number of things that are just a little bit different. You'll note then too that the org standards themselves, while they apply across the country, they are intentionally broad. Like you're going to read these sometimes and go, well, what does that really say? Or what does that really mean? Or how am I supposed to do that? And the org standards are not meant to be prescriptive because, you know, there's about 1,000 agencies coast to coast. We want agencies to be able to implement them the way that they see fit and also the way that makes sense in each state. So you'll note that there are not specific required documentation or processes prescribed in the standards themselves. Those requirements are really set by your state. And there are lots and lots of ways that states assess the CSBG organizational standards. And I'll encourage you to get familiar with how Hawaii does it. Courtney, is there anything that you would want to say about how Hawaii approaches your org standards assessment? Like, do folks, are they monitored once a year? Do they upload documentation? Is there some specific way it's done?
So since we do monitoring, we monitor two agencies every other year and alternate. The agencies that I don't monitor are typically asked to submit organizational standard documentation rather than doing the full on-site monitoring
That makes
process.
sense. I gotcha. So basically, for folks you're not visiting in person, you're going to get a desk, essentially a desk review, right? You upload your documentation, and then
Exactly.
otherwise, as part of your regular monitoring, you'll do org standards, right?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay, so that's how your state does it. There's your answer. As I said, states do it different ways, so don't let it confuse you. So along with this assessment, I just want to state the obvious that states then determine if standards are met or unmet. There's not really a partial credit option for the org standards. We already talked about they're intentionally broad. Kind of a somewhat controversial statement. I love that I'm being recorded. The CSBG organizational standards assessments, essentially, they verify that you do a thing,
Going
but I
through the
don't want
process.
you to confuse that with that it means that it's a really strong process, right? As in, you could do a risk assessment that is required by the standards, but that doesn't mean that you're doing a really high quality risk assessment, if that makes sense. You could do a community assessment, but it might not, you know, and check the box, but it might not be the best in class practice, right? So don't confuse that just because you do the thing for the org standards and it works for it, that that means it's a best in class practice, right? And I'll encourage you to live into the best in class practices. I'll say more on that in just a minute. The other thing I want to make sure I say is that standards are not all created equal because some standards are tied to legal requirements. As in, if you were to miss one of those standards that's tied to a legal requirement, you have a bigger problem than just you missed a standard. So, for instance, if your board is not in compliance with the tripartite board requirements, that could be a major challenge for your organization because you're required to have a tripartite board to for your CSBG funding, right? Or if you're not filing your 990, you're going to have an IRS problem, and not just a, oops, I missed an org standard problem. Okay. So as we go, I'll try to call out where there are some specific requirements that are tied to legal requirements for you to be aware of. This is the slide that I call the lower your blood pressure slide. And I want to say, although, of course, we want to see you meet 100% of the organizational standards every year, I also want to say that, guys, sometimes things happen and sometimes you don't get 100%. Okay. And I want to say that missing one standard, so long as it's not tied to one of those legal requirements, and it's not a pattern of you're constantly missing the same standard or having the same problem over and over again, it's not likely to result in catastrophic consequences. So, states really aren't going to terminate your funding if they don't follow that process that's in CSBGIM 116 or the CSBG Act. Like, there's very specific things that have to happen for you to lose your funding. So, because a board member rotated off the board before they signed a conflict of interest policy, are you going to lose your funding? Probably not, right? Like, the standards, but missing standards will likely result in you having a corrective action plan, a technical assistance plan, or even a quality improvement plan. That is part of what the state is meant to do in assessing the standards. And I do want to say, though, consistently missing the same standard, having a pattern of non-compliance, that could get you on a road towards termination of funding. But if you're just kind of like, if you just had like something random happened, you had some spilled milk, didn't get the conflict of interest policy, oops, this wasn't signed in time, that generally is not, a catastrophic consequence. And then, right, some of those standards do tie to other requirements, and I'll call those out for you. So as we go, I just think it's worthwhile to understand how to approach the org standards. And I always say on this slide, don't run away from them like the woman on the slide. Don't be afraid of them. It is okay. One of the first things I recommend that you do with the org standards is first identify what the requirements are of the standard. So for each standard, go through and ask yourself, what is the intention of the requirements or the guidance? What does the state require is a really important question. Does your state have specific guidance on what you have to do to meet the requirement? And I'll tell you, sometimes I see agencies who think that they're not meeting a standard because they're reading a requirement that isn't there. Maybe they're trying to make it a best practice kind of standard when it really isn't what the standard calls for. Or vice versa. Sometimes we see, where a state maybe thinks that something really needs to be stronger, that goes beyond the requirement, of a standard. So first and foremost, make sure that you understand what are the requirements and what does the state say you have to do. Identify any documentation requirements. And again, if your state has specific guidance, you want to ask them, Courtney, is there like a document that outlines what folks need to provide for each standard in the state?
Not a specific document. We do use, I believe it is NCAP's self-assessment tool that provides examples, but we don't provide anything hard, just to allow that flexibility for each agency.
That's a beautiful practice, and we love to hear that. I think that sometimes where we get into trouble is when it gets too prescriptive, and agencies are all different, and they call things different things, and they do things a little different. So love to hear that you have that flexibility. And then just always, 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 friends, clarify questions about the standards with your state CSBG office because they're the ones who are going to determine if you meet or don't meet a standard. And then my last kind of advice to you is read the standards both in context and as a whole, and think about linkages between the standards because there are some standards that if you miss it, it's going to show up again in a different standard. And so you could almost have a domino effect where you end up missing several standards just because you missed one. Customer satisfaction is a really good example of that. If you don't collect customer satisfaction data, then there's a tie between that and your CSBG, or I'm sorry, and your strategic plan, because you have to actually use customer satisfaction data in your strategic planning process. So that one standard could result in you missing actually two standards. So make sure that you're looking for those linkages. So I just want to do a kind of low stakes example here. So here's standard 1.2. The organization analyzes information collected directly from low-income individuals as part of the community assessment. Friends, to meet this standard, what do you think you have to do? What's one thing that you have to do? One practice. Last two words of the standard are a thing you have to do. Yeah, your community needs assessment, right? You have to have a community assessment. What do you have to do in that community assessment? What has to be included in there? You have to collect information from specifically people with low incomes, and then identifying the needs of people, right? So we have to actually get people's input. And then in the very first line, there is an A word about what you have to do with that data. You have to analyze it, right? So to do this one standard, there are three kind of things that have to happen. You have to have a community assessment, you have to collect information from people with low incomes, and you have to analyze the data. So if you were to think about how you might document that you've done those things, how might you do that? How might you show that you have done this? Where might this reside? Where might you detail this? How about in that community assessment report that you put out at the end of your community needs assessment, right? Everybody has to issue a report. You would probably detail that you did this within that community assessment report, and that will be your documentation. So for the standards, I'm not going to spend time on linkages right now, but for the standards, this is really what you want to make sure you do is you go into what are the requirements, what do I have to do, and what documentation do I need to show that I've done the thing. So I mentioned this already. You're going to have to do some balancing here of both fully living into the intent of the standard, so not just doing a community assessment, but doing a really good community assessment because that's what your community needs and deserves. And sometimes, friends, life happens, and we're going to have to do the bare minimum that we can to make sure that we're compliant, right? We don't love it when that happens, but sometimes it happens. We can't be 100% the best in everything, everywhere, all at once, all of the time. So I do just want to note that some standards can be a little more difficult than others. And usually what makes them a little more difficult has to do with dependencies. So where, you have to have one thing to get to do another standard. Sometimes the documentation is a challenge. And I want to acknowledge that there are a number of standards that require board action. And sometimes we just don't put things in board minutes. And then we end up with a missed standard because we don't have the documentation. And then the one that's really relevant to category eight is depth of knowledge, because the person usually who's putting together the materials for the CSBG org standards is probably not the financial person who's doing a lot of the practices in category eight, right? In some cases, you might be the same person, but in a lot, it is not. So this depth of knowledge can make a standard more difficult. Because it also might mean that you have to work across a team or across different kinds of teams to get what you need and make sure that the practices fulfill the requirements of the standards. I just want to say to you, high level, guys, if you ever get stuck with a standard where you're like, I don't know what to do, I have a question, there are so many lifelines out there. One of the best things about this network are it's people. So reach out to your colleagues. Hey, how have you dealt with this? How do you show that you meet this? Your state association, which in Hawaii you have an association that can support you with that, or at least help you connect to other CAAs. Your state office is a great help. And sometimes folks do contact us at NCAP, and we're always happy to kind of give you guidance when we have it available. So with that, I want to dive into category eight, which is really the meat of what we're going to do here today. I do plan to cover all 10 of the standards, and here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you the standard. I am going to tell you what the requirements are. I'll give you any kind of interpretation or guidance that we have. And Courtney, at any point, if I say anything that Hawaii has more specific guidance, please throw in. But friends, as we're going, if you have questions, bring them forward. We want to know if you're not sure what something means or how you do something. This is the time for you to ask. I'll also cover any required documentation. And then if I have some best practices or some tools that I can give you for those standards, I will also show those to you. I am also going to try to do the balancing act of here are some best practices, but also, not try to overstate the requirements of the standard. So I'm not going to read all of these to you right now, but know that there are 10 standards in category eight. All agencies in Hawaii are private community action agencies, so you don't need to worry about, did I say that right, Courtney? There's no public community action agencies. So you don't need to worry about any of those that say public. Okay, so I just want to acknowledge right off the top here that one of the key skills for category eight is working with fiscal staff. Because as I said, a lot of times the person who's putting this together is not the same person who is doing a lot of the fiscal stuff. And so some of the challenges that we see in category eight can just be related to working across teams. One of the things that we always hear about that can really help with this practice is to remember that even though our fiscal friends have different priorities than maybe our program friends, we all have a common goal, right? We're all working towards the same mission and purpose. Our fiscal friends could probably go to the private sector and make a lot more money there, but they choose to work in this nonprofit sector because they know and care about the work. And so, I think just as much as we can center ourselves in those common goals, it will really go a long way. I think also when we can clarify roles and responsibilities, the CSPG org standards person is not trying to do the finance person's job, nor is the finance person trying to do the program person's job. That can go a long way too. Bridging communication gaps, I see this all the time. And I think one of the best examples of this, when I go to make like a financial purchase, I always talk in cost center name, right? Like I don't think in terms of what's like the cost center number, but like I might be contacting my fiscal person and saying, I want to use this money from this cost center. And inevitably, the fiscal person will come back and they'll say, what's the cost center number, right? And I think that that is like the best example of I think in words because I'm a more of a program person, and my fiscal colleague thinks in numbers because they're more of a numbers person. Their first question to me is, what are the numbers, right? So the more that we can figure out how to bridge some of those communication gaps, we might use different words, we might say different things, that will go a long way. And then also just encouraging training for mutual understanding. I'm curious, how many of you here on the call are fiscal people? Like, can you raise your hand or give me a thumbs up in the with your React button? Okay, there's a few of you who are fiscal people. So Fiscal friends. Oh, there's a lot of you who are fiscal people. Oh my goodness. Okay. Now I'm intimidated because now I've said I don't think in terms of in terms of numbers. I think in terms of words. Please don't hate me. But I'm so happy to hear that because often we don't see the fiscal people in a training like this. Who we see are the program people. And we really need all of you to understand what the requirements are too, because you want to help your program people meet the requirements, right? That's what you're here to do. I'm curious, friends, is there any advice, any one of you, any fiscal staff or program staff on the call that you would have for how program and fiscal can work well together? Is there something that you do in your organization that allows you to be really effective working together? Would anyone be willing to share one thing that they do or a piece of advice for a colleague about how to make that happen? And you can come off mute. You can put it in the chat. Anything that you do so that you can work across teams. Yeah, open communication. I love that. Not just kind of leaving folks and your finance and your program and never shall you talk, right? That doesn't help, does it? Regular meetings. Yeah, it goes such a long way. Touch base prior to unusual transactions. I think that makes a lot of sense, right? Like, hey, I just have a question about this, right? What's this for? How can we, yep. What is this trying to accomplish, right? That's really good. Embracing the role of supporting them. Right. Nobody wants to be the one to say, you can't do that, right? But asking, what are you trying to accomplish with this? Even if maybe it's not allowed, but if you understand what they're trying to do, maybe you can find a way to get to yes. Maybe it's not the way they're trying to do it. Maybe there's another way to help your program people get to yes by understanding what their intentions are, and what they're trying to accomplish. So I love that. Thank you all. That's some really good advice that you gave, each other. I appreciate that. So, how about if we dive into standard 8.1? Here we go. Standard 8.1 requires that you have an annual audit completed by a certified public accountant on time in accordance with Title II of, uniform guidance and or any state audit threshold requirements. So, the intent here is to assure that an external audit, not an audit from within your organization, but an external audit by a certified public accountant is completed and meets all of the applicable laws and funding requirements. So, a couple things to know about this standard. The standard refers to specific audit requirements. You need to make sure that you are fulfilling those requirements. For nonprofits, based on your budget size and funding source. I'm going to show you the thresholds in just a second. The other thing that really tends to be more of the problem, I think, than having an audit is actually the on-time piece. We see a number of organizations who are really struggling with getting their audits done on time, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And I probably have a question for you all about that in a minute. So, just to clarify that the audit is really meant to be an independent review of your financial records, and it's done by that licensed CPA. Only licensed CPAs can issue an audit. A review of transactions from within your organization is not, an audit by this definition. But that's really what we're trying to get to. You also want to make sure that you check for any state variance with the federal threshold. Anyone who expends more than $1 million in federal awards needs to have a single audit. And that's not just, all of our grants are federal and they're all $900,000. So we don't have to have an audit. No, it's if you expend more than $1 million of federal funding, then you have to have a single audit. And then also a reminder that it's not just having the audit done. You do have to send a summary report to the Federal Audit Clearinghouse. That has to be done as well. And the audit submission deadline is 9 months after the end of the fiscal year. So this is really where I think agencies are getting into trouble. I also think that post-COVID, there might have been some extension in this. And I kind of feel like we maybe got into a pattern where our audits were behind and it's been a little challenging to get back on time. So your documentation for 8.1 is pretty straightforward. You need to have a physical or electronic copy of the audit report and the related information. You should have your receipt where you posted it to the Federal Clearinghouse. And then, maybe you want the receipt of the audit related to the 9 month deadline, right? You want to show that you did this on time for your organization. So before I move ahead, I am curious. We have seen trouble with this standard recently. I do commonly missed standards frequently around the country, and I always ask states, what are the commonly missed standards? This used to be one that never came up, and this is one that comes up actually more and more often. So I'm wondering, if you have any thoughts about why that might be or what the struggle actually is it timing? Is it not finding auditors? Is it the cost of an audit? Like, is if you're having or you've seen this problem or know of this problem, is there something that you've seen that's driving it from your perspectives? Is there anything that's come up with this one? Difficulty with change of auditors. Yeah. And, I assume that you're talking about after you've solicited a new auditor, right? Working with a new auditor, it's like, man, it's like a new marriage. I don't know what else to say. It takes a lot of time, right? It takes more time to do the same thing that you could have done with your old auditor. They have a lot more questions. You need to do a lot more training, and that can really extend your time. Notice a shrinkage of the market of CPAs doing single audits. That is, ex yes. I mean, and I think that that's true for sure in lots of states. What I want to say, friends, is that if you are bumping into this problem, we're going to talk about soliciting bids for your audit in just a minute. But if you're like soliciting bids and you're not getting what you need, please, reach out to NCAP because we can also help you connect with some different audit firms who, we won't endorse anybody. Of course, Wipfli is an endorsed vendor with NCAP. Wipfli does audits, but beyond that, we're not going to endorse any one entity. And, who's a good auditor for one organization might not be a good auditor for another, but we could at least, point you towards some auditors that you could chat with or solicit a bid from if you're having that problem. So thanks for surfacing those things. Okay, so 8.2 then builds on 8.1. All findings from the prior year's annual audit have been assessed by the organization and addressed where the governing board has deemed it appropriate. So the intent here is to ensure that you don't just have an audit and go, yeah, whatever, and then just keep doing what you were doing before, where obviously there was a problem, right? So we have to ensure that the previous audit findings are acted upon. And that really is a sign of a key financial control to ensure, ongoing good management. So the standard requires that the previous year audit findings are assessed. It does not necessarily require action on all audit items. So you all have probably experienced this once or twice, where sometimes an auditor finds something and the organization perhaps disagrees with the finding. And the board says, we're not going to do anything with that. We're just not going to take action on that recommendation. And that's within your right to do that. Sometimes there's spilled milk, right? Something happened. It, didn't follow policy, it whatever, and there's not really an action to take. Or, maybe it's just a simple training thing, whatever it may be. The requirement for this standard is not that you have to take action on all audit findings. I have some other feelings about that, but that's not what the standard says. The standard does require, though, that the CAA take action on findings where the board has identified follow-up. So if the board says we need to take action on these things, then we should be able to see that the agency has taken action based on those things that the board prioritized. And of course, here the best practices address all your audit findings so that you don't get repeat findings, because then you could have a lack of adequate controls, could be a future finding if you're not following up on what's come up in your audits before. So this documentation really ties to your response to any audit findings. So that might be if you have a corrective action plan, or documentation of the training that you did, or whatever that may be. And then we also want to see that you've reviewed the corrective action plan or what you've done with the board. And that might be in the board minutes, it might be a special report. It could be any one of those things. There's not like one piece of documentation that you're going to submit for this. It's going to depend on kind of what you have going on here. And I'll acknowledge that a lot of times this is kind of a NA almost, or a met by default, because hopefully you're not having findings in your audit anyway. Guys, as I'm going, if you have questions, if you have feedback, if you have thoughts about any of this or advice, please put it in the chat or come off mute. I'd love to hear your voices too. So, staying in the audit space, Standard 8.3, the organization's auditor presents the audit to the governing board. And the intent here is to assure that the board has direct access to the auditor by essentially requiring the auditor to present the audit directly to them. It ensures that there is no kind of miscommunication, or in a worst case scenario, like changing the message or purposefully withholding information from the board by anyone, right? So this standard is really clear. The auditor has to present the audit to the board. And this is the auditor presenting to a committee, like your finance committee, actually does not meet the requirements of this standard. The auditor has to present to the full board. The full board is responsible for the financial well-being of that organization, not just the audit committee or your finance committee. So that's why that's the case. We say it's ideal if this can be done in person. That is not always possible. But really, the thing that is so critical is that you have that direct communication between the auditor and the board. Now, you're probably saying to me, Mary Beth, we have done this many times, and the auditor presents, and then he asks or she asks, are there any questions? And the board stares blankly back at the auditor. And so I love this tool. And guys, you'll get the slides. You'll have the links to all of these things so that you can check these things out. But I love this resource from the National Council of Nonprofits. It gives you six questions that you could give your board members to invite them to ask of the auditor so that they're kind of engaging in their fiscal oversight role. Because sometimes I think people just don't even know what to ask, right? A lot of our board members don't come with financial training kind of in their background, so they might not even know where to begin. So you could use these six questions as a way to kind of help them get started. I was trying to click the link and be able to post it here for you, but that's not going to work for me right now. So I'll just keep rolling here. But you'll be able to access this resource. You could give them these six questions, and then hopefully the next time that your auditor presents to your board, you'll have a little bit more robust of a conversation. So your documentation for 8.3 is also fairly straightforward. We need to see that the auditor presented to the board, and that's usually, an agenda and the minutes of the governing board meeting. So yes, we are going to share the slides after the training, Jojo, for sure. And then that way you'll have all the links and all the materials that we're sharing here. Because I have a number of links and tools I want you to be sure that you have access to. And then, any documentation of the content of the discussion, maybe you have the PowerPoint presentation that the auditor did, or handouts or whatever that is, that all will help your state office to know that the discussion actually happened. The agenda itself, the board meeting agenda isn't enough, because we all know you could have it on the agenda and it not happen for whatever reason. So make sure that you're providing those board meeting minutes or your the actual materials that went to the board for this standard. Okay. Okay, so let's move ahead to 8.4. The governing board formally receives and accepts the audit. So the intention here for 8.4 is to assure the formal action by the board, acknowledging receipt of the audit. So the standard requires a formal motion that the audit be accepted. It does not require that the board approves the audit, right? Because they're not financial people. They're not, approving the work of the auditor. They're accepting that the audit has been provided to them. It also might mean, though, guys, like sometimes there might be disagreement between an auditor and the findings, or the board might not agree with the findings that the auditor puts forward. The board still needs to accept the audit because it has to be completed for your federal funding. This is one of those requirements that you have to be sure that you are doing. So make sure that the board does accept the audit. They're not approving the audit in this case. And obviously we feel strongly that the best practice here is all board members should receive a complete copy of the audit, not just a summary, not just that PowerPoint presentation that the auditor might do. Make sure that the board has access to all of the things. So for 8.4, your documentation here is board receipt of the audit. So that might be, here's the email where we provided everyone the audit, the board acknowledgement of receipt in the minutes, and then also in your board minutes, that board acceptance of the audit that has to be in your board minutes. I don't know another way for you to show that you've done this without good board minutes. So any questions so far? Anything coming up for folks? I promise we're about to leave audit stuff, which will make some of us very happy, I know. So here's the one that might garner some conversation. So the organization has to solicit bids for its audit within the past 5 years. And the intent here is to assure that there is competition for the audit to reduce the possibility of an improper long-term relationship between the CAA and the auditor. It's great to work with the same auditor over and over again because it makes our lives easier. And the longer that we work with an auditor, the more risk happens, right? Because it's easier for an auditor to say, I'll let something slide. Or the auditor might just kind of get complacent and stop asking a whole lot of questions because they think they understand something where maybe they don't really understand what's going on, right? So we want to ensure that there is an opportunity for a new auditor. Now, it does not require, the standard does not say that you must change auditors as a result of your bid process. You are not required to do that. So you could put it out to bid every 5 years and select the same auditor in the next cycle. That is allowed. But you do have to at least solicit that bid. And by the way, the other thing that can be a little funny about this, so this standard requires you to solicit bids. Even if that audit amount is underneath like your procurement threshold, you will still have to solicit a bid for your audit services. Okay. It's not just about your procurement requirements. So a tool that I do want to be sure that I share with you is this soliciting bids for auditors, or this, I'm sorry, this nonprofit auditor selection guide, because I know that selecting an auditor can be a huge task and a big thing. This selection guide gives you some really great tools to it gives you like a sample letter for soliciting the bids. It gives you a great interview guide. It even has like an evaluation tool to help you evaluate the bids that you receive. So when you get these slides, do check out this auditor selection guide. And there's also another really good tool from Propel Nonprofits out there. So there's lots of good tools in this space, honestly, but I'll be sure to share this one with you. So when it comes to soliciting your bids for auditors, You always want to start with kind of defining the scope and the timeline for the audit. That timeline is really, really important because you all know it gets tight. And remember, our audits have to be on time in order for us to meet 8.1, and also just for our federal funding because we receive federal funding, so we have to have our audits on time. So you want to get really clear on that. And then you want to make sure that that timeline also accounts for the time that you're going to need to evaluate your auditor, or for to put the call for bid out, enough time for auditors to respond to that bid, and then also enough time for you to evaluate who you want to work with, and enough time for them to kind of get up to speed before audit is really started and due. So I'm curious, friends, how far out are you putting your audits out for bid? Like when you're putting them out, how far in advance are you doing that? Nine months. Any trouble with that timeline, or is it working for you? You might see my skepticism. I mean, 9 months seems like a long time, but I also know it can probably get a little hectic in that 9 months. Is it mostly working? It's working. Wonderful. I love that. Good for you. I love that that works. Other folks, how far out are you doing this? 3 to, oh my goodness, 3 to 4 months. Okay. And you're still getting responses and getting what you need. I will just encourage you that, there's not a person that I talk to in this world anymore who can say, yeah, I'm less busy than I was 5 years ago. So as folks get busier and busier, making sure that you are really giving time, a good timeline for the quality auditors that you really want to bid on your audit, the time that they need to be able to give you that bid. So, okay, so once you have your scope, you're going to develop your RFP, and then solicit and collect bids from qualified audit firms. And then, of course, you're going to have to review the proposals and compare their qualifications, their experience, and cost. You are not required to go with the lowest cost audit. Cost is a big piece of it, but obviously, if the auditor doesn't have the qualifications you need, they don't have the experience you need, you don't have to go with that auditor. And then some folks do like to do interviews with their auditors. I think it makes a lot of sense. They're going to be deep in your work in the organization, so you want to be sure that you all can work together. So those interviews can be really important as well. You can also do this work through your audit committee, and if you don't have an audit committee, you can use your finance committee to kind of help guide and engage the board in the process as well. So make sure you check out this resource when you get the slides. So let's look at 8.5 guidance on your documentation. So what do you need? You will need to show your proposal that you put out for sure. And then if you got responses, I don't know that the state needs to see all of the responses that you got, but to see that you did receive response. And then if you have like a scoring grid or evaluation sheet that kind of details, that you did some deliberative process before you decided on the auditor that you ultimately went with. I think that's especially important if you're not changing auditors to show like you worked the process. Sometimes you are going to put the audit out for bid and you're only going to get one response. And in that case, it is really important that you're showing that you made a good effort to put it out there. You put it on your website, you sent emails to several audit firms. You really worked the process. So this is the kind of documentation that you will need. Who's ready to move beyond audit? I'm ready to move beyond audit. So let's talk about standard 8.6. Yes, let's talk about something other than audits. And for anybody who's like living audit time, it's audit time at NCAP. We're all like, yes, let's not talk about the audit anymore, please. Thank you. So the IRS Form 990 is completed annually and made available to the governing board for review. This is one of those standards, friends, that if you're not doing this, you have bigger problems than just missing an org standard. You have an IRS problem. So the intent here is you've got to be filing your IRS 990s regularly to maintain your 501c3 status. You do have to be, it does have to be submitted annually. It is okay for this form to be submitted under an extension. That is acceptable. A lot of organizations do that. Just so long as it is done for each year, that is what you need to do here. And then it's not enough just to file it. The board needs to know what's in that 990, right? They're legally responsible for the well, the financial well-being of the organization. So make sure that we've got receipt of the by the board recorded in some way. You might do that with an emailed re-read receipt, or if you use board software, I know some organizations are using kind of a board software, you could do that. Signed receipt, distributed in a board meeting, whatever that is, make sure that we can see that the board did actually receive the 990. So your documentation then here is pretty obvious, right? We need to see that the 990 was filed. So, you know, the physical or electronic copy is available. And then however you document that it was ultimately given to the board in the packet, in the minutes, email, whatever that is, you should be sure that you include that as well. So the 991 isn't that exciting, but it is really, really, really important to make sure that it is done. For folks who have 990 questions, I want to flag that one of our partners, CBIZ, has a webinar upcoming on optimizing the Form 990 and how to kind of handle the 990, especially, you know, kind of in this moment where there's a lot of increased focus on nonprofit organizations. So I'll encourage you to kind of check out that webinar. And it has been in NCAP's e-news. We've been promoting that webinar as available. And Courtney, I'll be sure to send that webinar to you to send out with the materials from today. Okay. Not a lot of discussion to be had on Form 990. I'm going to move us ahead then to 8.7. The governing board receives financial reports at each regular meeting that include the following: the organization-wide report on revenue and expenditures that compares budget to actual, categorized by program, along with the balance sheet and statement of financial position. So the intent here is that we need the board to be aware of the fiscal condition of the organization, right? This is essentially, you know, the fiduciary responsibility of the board. They have to know the financial condition. These both of these things are required for a reason. The budget to actual is important for folks for the board to know. They approved an agency-wide budget. They have to know how you're spending compared to that budget that they approved. The categorized by program is really important because you all know that there can be sometimes programs that run a deficit and programs that are that run a surplus. And we don't want those kinds of things to kind of hide in just a one big overall report. You know, we want the board to have the detail that they need to understand how programs are actually performing and impacting the overall bottom line. So you need both big picture and bottom and like more detailed picture for the board. And then the balance sheet and statement of financial position is also going to help them to see the, again, overall financial condition of the organization. So the interpretation here, just to clarify a couple of things on this standard. The standard requires two very specific reports at every regular board meeting. So you do not have to do this at special board meetings. You don't have to provide these two things. But if you have a regularly scheduled board meeting, this has to be there. The standard does not allow you to defer those to the next meeting. That was something we've seen once or twice. The board should always be talking about the financial condition of the organization. We shouldn't be deferring important conversations about our financials. The other thing to note here is that, this is organization-wide. It's not just CSBG or LIHEAP or, those kinds of programs. It's really the entirety of the organization. The board is responsible for the entire organization, so they have to see the whole thing. That said, how these reports look agency to agency is incredibly different. You will have to determine the appropriate amount or level of fiscal reporting or the best way to give these reports to your board. So I want to show you kind of a neat example of maybe a different way to do some of the reporting that you're required to do. Now, I want to say to you what I'm about to show you is not required by the standard, but I frequently hear, challenges with getting the board to engage in the financial space. Again, I think in part because board members don't come out of the box like with like deep financial acumen and know-how and training before they sit on the board. Some do, but a lot don't. So I want to show you this really neat example. I got this from the nonprofit Financial Commons and their partner, nonprofit Financial Acumen. And you'll be able to check out this link, and there's a really good article that goes alongside these examples. So let's see. Let me ask you all, how many of you does your financial reporting to the board look something like this? We have our, our categories with our revenue and our income statement with our revenue, our expenses, our year to date, our budget, yada yada, right? And kind of line by line, and then you break this out by program probably. How many of you does this look like what you already do? You can give me a thumbs up or a reaction. Okay. Maybe not. Maybe folks aren't doing like this anymore. Okay. So this is a pretty common approach though, is like, here's our just our numbers, yada yada. So a practice that you could do to help the board better understand the financial condition of the organization, one is to provide an executive summary at the beginning of each financial report. So, state any of the kind of big things that the board really needs to be aware of in the financials that they are about to look at. So, provide that summary to them up front. Then, the other smart thing to do is to number and letter the lines so that if a board member has a question about a particular item, if you've ever done this hunt and peck game about, are we looking at the same line? This goes a long way to help ensure that we're all talking about the same thing. Yeah, I have a question about C9. What happened there? Why do we have this amount of other revenue? What is that, right? It makes it very easy versus going total other revenue, this amount, what's that, right? So this just gets us on the same page. And then you'll notice that there's this notes section. And so, for anything that you have more specific detail that you want the board to be tuned into, you can go ahead and number that and make it such that we can then provide more detail. So, then you can attach this kind of notes section that will provide the more specific written detail to go alongside of your financial reports. Isn't that kind of fun? I think that's a kind of fun way to do it. Questions or thoughts or advice for your colleagues on this one? Do you like this example? Okay, well, I will move ahead then. I hope that this is helpful. Do read the article. It is a really good read for sure. Oh, what is a typical lag time between report and meeting date? That's a really good question, Gregory. I think it's a good question for your colleagues, friends. How much lag do you have between report and your meeting? Like if you're meeting in May, what kind of reporting are they seeing? Are they seeing April? Are they seeing February and March and May? Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Oh, maybe because you're meeting bi-monthly. My instinct is that that is a very typical timeline. Usually you're not reporting on the most recently closed period because we know what a mess the most recently closed period is. It's usually the period prior, right? So if you're meeting in May, you're probably giving March's report. I don't know if anybody else has another practice, but I would say that's pretty typical. I once heard Denise Toby from Wipfli tell people that there's no reason that they shouldn't be able to close their books in 15 days from the end of the period. So if you can't, by that logic, that means your board should absolutely at the very latest be getting, the prior month in the month that they're, or, 2 months prior in the month that they're meeting. I hope that helps, Gregory. It's a good question. Excuse me. So for your documentation in 8.7, obviously we want to see the board agenda. We want to see the board meeting packet with all of those required reports, your minutes that show that you have actually, talked about the reports that you provided. If you want to attach an email, wonderful. You're not really required to do that. And I should have said this from the get-go, guys. Like, this is a suggestion of documents. It's not saying you must provide all of these things in order to fulfill the requirements of the standard, but usually it's a selection of these kinds of things that go together. Okay, that is 8.7. Let me show you 8.8. All required filings and payments related to payroll withholdings are completed on time. This is really simple. We want to assure that the agency is fulfilling its obligations legally to its employees and fulfilling those state and federal requirements, right? Not, making your tax withholding payments to, the feds and to the states on time is a huge, huge, huge problem. And I'll tell you, anytime that NCAP has the very unfortunate case of being called into an agency who is in trouble, this is one of the very first questions we ask them is, are you up to date on paying your taxes, right? And paying your filings on time. And if they tell us no, we know we're in a pretty serious situation here, okay? So if you are finding yourself having trouble doing this, I'm gonna highly recommend that you get some counsel and get some help to kind of rectify that or get to the root cause of that or get the help that you need to kind of get back on track. And if you don't know where to start, CAPLAW is a wonderful, wonderful resource for all things legal. Reach out to CAPLAW if you're having a problem like this. And then we just want to clarify that the interpretation here is not just that you're doing your federal, state, and local taxes, but also, if you're taking out insurance payments out of someone's paycheck, you also need to be sure that you're then paying the insurance company for that insurance policy, right? I haven't heard of this within the Community Action Network, but certainly have heard of nonprofits who withheld insurance from someone's paycheck and then didn't pay the insurance bill. And people, it was not good, is what I will say. That was not a good situation for that organization. But also retirement payments as well. Have also kind of heard horror stories of that, where organizations weren't depositing funds into the retirement accounts for their organizations. So make sure that these things are being done. Obviously, your documentation may include information from the payroll service. A lot of us do use a payroll service to kind of do these things. The financial management system, that's all good. So your documentation here is pretty straightforward, guys. Your payroll tax returns, your copies of checks, any of your retirement plan documents, you know, all of this kind of stuff that just shows what did I withhold? Did I make my payment on time? That is really what the state needs to see here. Courtney, you came back on camera. Did you have something you wanted to add or just coming back?
Nope, just coming back.
Okay, wonderful. I wondered if I said something funny that needed cleaning up. That happens sometimes. When you talk for an hour and a half, you start saying funny things, so who knows? Okay, we are coming towards the end of our time together here. I want to acknowledge that. I promise I'm getting you out of here on time. Standard 8.9 says that the governing board has to annually approve an organization-wide budget. The intent here is to assure that the board is able to exercise its financial oversight, right? Rather than through a set of project budgets. As we talked about, it can be really easy in kind of project budgets to lose sight of the big picture. And that is why it is so critical that the board annually approves an organization-wide budget. So this is not the same thing as just like, here's a whole bunch of different or individual budgets all packaged together. Really, the board has to see all of the things at the high level. And here's the other really thing important thing to know is that board action is required here. This isn't the agency just operates. This is here's the budget, and the board approves that budget. And that has to go in your meeting minutes. There was something else I wanted to say about your organization-wide budget. I feel like this used to be a bigger challenge for organizations than it is today. I think that software has made this a lot easier for us. And I think that conceptually, we've kind of gotten our heads around, you know, this idea. I recognize that the thing that tends to make this difficult is different grants having different periods. So if you have a grant that ends on, you know, 9:30, and you're a July or and you're a excuse me, a December or January to December budget period. Well, then what do you do for that period from 9:30 to 12:30, right? Like, do I anticipate that I'm going to get the grant again? Do I not anticipate that I'm going to get the grant again? Or, you know, if you have this kind of staggering start and stop periods, that is part of what can make this so challenging. Really, the best advice is that you have to take your best guess. Your budget is your best guess. You know, make sure though that when you're working with those guesses and those assumptions, that everybody understands what they are, right? So if you're assuming that the grant is going to come through on 10-1, well, then we better understand that that is what we're anticipating to happen. And if it doesn't, we understand that we might have to make some different moves, right? So this is what's really important to know about Standard 8.9. Your documentation here is pretty straightforward. You need the copy of the approved budget, the budget presentation that you do to the board meeting agenda, and the minutes are really gonna or what are going to show that the budget was approved by the governing board. I had something else I wanted to say on this one. It will come to me at 3 in the morning and I will text all of you because I know actually my 3 in the morning, you all might still be up really and truly, but yeah, it's possible, right? Okay, then 8.10, the fiscal policies have been reviewed by staff within the past 2 years, updated as necessary with changes approved by the governing board. So again, because your board is ultimately responsible for the financial well-being of the organization, they have to approve the policies that guide how you do money in the organization, right? So we want to be sure too that those policies are current, that they reflect current best practice, and that the board is aware of what those are, right? So the interpretation here is that the standards requires fiscal policies, and it says presumably written. I don't know how you'd have any policy that isn't written at this time, but you know, you have to have fiscal policies. They have to undergo a formal review by the staff within the past 2 years. That no ifs, ands, or buts about that. I do want to flag for you though, the standard does not require that changes have to be made. You could review the policies and say, you know what? We don't see that anything is necessary at this time. That is okay for, to have that happen. And note that the standard says with changes approved by the governing board. So if there are no changes, the board doesn't necessarily need to reapprove the same policies. That is not what is required by the standard. Now, do I have some thoughts and feelings on this? I sure do. And I'll tell you, the standards of excellence, which are kind of, you know, the best, the true best in class practices of community action agencies, we say that you have to do this review annually and the board should approve your fiscal policies whenever changes occur. So it should be happening much more frequently. And we want to be sure that the board is fully aware of what is in those fiscal policies. They should always kind of be in front of the board. But yeah, this one gets a little sticky because sometimes folks think that you have to have the board approve every 2 years. It is not what the standard says, or that they have to make changes every 2 years. It's not what the standard says. So 4.8.10, I do want to flag that there, as folks who receive federal funds, you agree to comply with uniform guidance. And uniform guidance does have some requirements about some of the things that should be in your fiscal policies. And so I really recommend that you make sure that you've gone through uniform guidance to make sure that your policies include the policies that you have to have. Like you have to have policies on your retention of records, how you make payments, how you determine allowability of costs, your conflict of interest, your procurement, travel, all of these things all have to be within your agency's fiscal policies. There are probably more. This is probably just a selection of just some of the ones that you want to make sure that you have. So for 8.10, you need your documentation of your policies themselves. And then you need some way to document that your staff did that review. Now, this might be done via committee meeting, right? Maybe you have a great committee that focuses on fiscal policy. You can work with them. You might show that there's a red line document, some other policy manual that was reviewed. You need to have some way to show that we did what we were supposed to do. It might even be a staff report to the board that says, we reviewed the policy. Here's what we found. We don't recommend any changes be made. That would be a really good practice to help you meet this requirement. And then anytime that there are changes, we want to see that, you know, they went to the board, that they were approved, and that board packet has the policies attached. Okay, so that's 8.10. We've got 10. I feel like I am missing some slides in my presentation. Please hold 1 second while I work through this. While I do that awkwardly, everybody, do you folks have any questions on any of the things that we have covered so far, or comments, or thoughts, or a good joke while I try to figure out where my slides went? Okay, so I don't see, I'm glad that folks find this helpful. So my slides are doing something goofy. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to show you less pretty slides, okay, so that we can get through the last couple. But I want to make sure that I cover the content with you and but I'll still be able to do the same things with you. They just don't look as pretty. And when I send them, Courtney, I'll be sure that these are all formatted for you, okay? So, standard 8.11 says a written procurement policy is in place and has been reviewed by the governing board within the past 5 years. So, this standard really requires that you have to have a written procurement policy. We just covered that the uniform guidance requires you to have a written procurement policy. And then all the board has to do that approval because they are again financially responsible for the organization. These guidelines have been updated, so just know that there are some specific minimum requirements for procurement that are set within the uniform guidance. You'll want to use those limits for sure in your policies, but also know you might choose to use lower thresholds for whatever reason, right? Like your micro purchase, you might decide you want to be lower. That is okay. Know that there have been some updates to uniform guidance. And so make sure that you have also updated your policies to give yourself enough flexibility. We've seen some organizations get into trouble because they haven't updated some of those especially micro purchase policies. And they're just not giving themselves the flexibility that they need to be able to purchase things like in this economy, just to sound that way. So just make sure that you've got your policies aligned to what is flexible and realistic for you. When it comes to 8.11, you want to make sure too that your procurement policy meets both the federal and the state requirements. Because your state might also have additional thresholds that you need to consider. In this case, too, much like a couple of the other standards, review of changes by a board committee does not meet this standard, right? It has to be the full board who looks at the overall policy. And then you can also incorporate procurement into your fiscal policy to kind of meet this standard as well. So really, if you have your procurement policy within your fiscal policies, if you're doing your fiscal policies every 2 years, and at least that approval every 5, you're going to meet this standard as well. So your documentation here is your actual procurement policy. Any changes that you've made, and then if you've done changes, that board agenda, the meeting minutes, and the packet overall. Okay, then let's look at 8.12. The organization documents how it allocates shared costs through an indirect cost rate or through a written cost allocation plan. So, of course, nonprofit organizations, we have costs that are shared across all of the programs. We need to make sure that we have a standard way that we treat those shared costs through that indirect cost rate that is negotiated with the federal government or a cost allocation plan. Or I should also be sure I say not just a negotiated indirect cost rate, but also the de minimis rate. And again, I want to flag that there are recent changes to the uniform guidance and who is allowed to use the de minimis rate. And that de minimis rate might now make sense for some organizations where it did not make sense before. I know that you guys are going to have some training with KSOL on updates to the uniform guidance. I am in no way KSOL. I don't play KSOL on television. She is going to be the one that you're going to want to talk to about updates to the de minimis rate and what makes sense for your organization. She is a CPA. I am not. So, just want to, flag that there are these different ways for you to use, for you to allocate costs. You can use cost allocation, you can use de minimis indirect, or that federally negotiated indirect cost rate. I know a lot of organizations are having trouble getting updated federally negotiated indirect cost rates. They're taking a lot longer to go through, so you might be using provisional rates for a lot longer. That is a huge challenge. Again, I think that if you all are having that challenge, talking to CAPLAW, and then again, the KSOL training is going to be a really good opportunity for you all to talk through that. But the headline here is that you have to have a way that you allocate the costs. That is what is required. And once you use that method, that's what you have to use for the period, right? So, in terms of meeting this requirement, you have to have, that either that federally negotiated indirect cost rate, or that cost allocation plan ultimately. So your documentation is that rate, it's the plan, or if you're using the de minimis rate, this should be indicated on your grant forms that you receive from all of your different federal funding or from your different funding agencies. Okay. if you're electing to use the de minimis rate. Courtney shouldn't be coming out to monitor you on the org standards and then find out that you're using the de minimis rate. It should have already been kind of approved within your budget. So then 8.13, which is actually the last standard in the category of category 8, the organization has a written policy in place for record retention and destruction. You are required, remember, within uniform guidance to have policies on record retention and destruction. Form 990 asks you about this question. And by the way, a lot of states have requirements on record retention and destruction. So be sure that you get familiar with any requirements for the grants that you have. They're different retention periods and what you have to do with their destruction and when things have to be destroyed. Make sure you have a good, strong policy in place that makes that possible. You need a records retention person. You need someone to be in charge of that and to make sure that it gets done. And guys, be nice to that person. They have a hard job. It's not easy to keep track of all of these documents and make sure that they get retained properly and destroyed properly, especially. In terms of guidance here, the policy does need to cover both paper and electronic records. More and more we have electronic records than the paper records, but it should cover both. And the policy really should specify how records are destroyed, right? What is the methodology for that happening? Now, some of this might, if you're using like software for, like your client database or software for your financial stuff, that they might have some kind of natural built-in kind of record destruction. You want to be sure, though, that if that's happening, that it complies with what you needed to comply with and that it follows your required timelines as well. And really what you need here is a policy. That is the requirement. Do you have a written policy that guides your record retention and destruction? So I know I have 1 minute left. managed to fill up the whole time. Let me just leave you with at the end of my slides, I do have some linkages for you to help you see how there might be some different things that link to other requirements, although a lot of them really tie back to board action. So many of the standards in Category 8 tie directly to the board. So make sure that you're thinking about those things that have to go to the board, that they're being done on time, and that the board understands their role in that financial oversight. I have some tools at the end of this that I won't spend a lot of time covering because you can check them out on our website. And with that, we are right at time. I want to say thank you for your time, your attention, your participation, your questions. It's awesome. I'm really glad that I got to spend this time with you. If folks have questions, I'm happy to hang out for a couple minutes. Otherwise, though, I'll say thank you and have a great rest of your day. And for friends who want to hang on and chat, I'm here. Courtney, anything you want to add?
Nope. Thank you so much, Mary Beth. That was very informative.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Thanks,
Thank you, Mary
friends.
Beth.
Thank you, Jojo.
Bye, Courtney.
Bye, Jojo. Thank you all for coming.
Mary Beth, can I ask a quick question?
You sure can.
On those set of slides that you showed us with the micro purchase threshold, just confirming that those are older numbers, right?
Those are old numbers. When I send you, I don't know what happened to my PowerPoint. When I send you the correct formatted slides, they'll have the correct thresholds on there. Those are very old on those old ones.
Perfect, perfect. Thank you so much. I
Sure.
appreciate it.
Of course. Okay. If there's no other questions, then we will go ahead and wrap up. Bye, friends.